This is episode number 12 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, May 10th, 2007. I'm Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Up for discussion this week, after the FCC's media violence report, there are new legislative proposals to regulate violence in video games. The David and Goliath struggle with the Library of Congress over Washington Watch and trademark law. And Rupert Murdoch's surprise bid for ownership of the Wall Street Journal. Joining me to discuss these topics are Tech Liberation Front contributors, starting with Jim Harper of the Cato Institute. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Jerry.
Adam Thierer of the Progress and Freedom Foundation.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Adam. And Tim Lee of the Cato Institute.
Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Tim. Our guest this week is Peter Suderman of National Review Online. Glad to have you with
Hi
us,
there.
Peter. Hi.
Hi.
First up, our proposal to regulate violence in video games. Peter, you've been writing about this in NRO. What's going on here?
Well, there are a bunch of things going on. The main legislative front right now is, or one of the main ones anyway, is a proposed law called the Video Game Decency Act. And this is a law proposed by Representative Fred Upton, a Republican from Michigan. And basically what the law would do is that it would make it illegal for a video game company to lie to a ratings board or to misrepresent itself to a ratings board about a private ratings board about what content is in their games. This was brought up by the Grand Theft Auto hot coffee scandal, in which which caused a whole lot of fuss a while back. And basically, in that case, there was a video game called Grand Theft Auto, in which the programmers had coded in a sex scene, and they'd walled it off in the game, but some people had gone through the code and developed a modification that could be downloaded and sort of attached on, and which would allow players to get into this. And so so Upton's law would make it illegal and would give the FTC the authority to go in and fine and attack video game companies for doing that. The problem with this is that it's already illegal to lie to the ESRB, or because companies that work with the ESRB, and this is every major gaming company, sign an agreement, and the ESRB already has power to fine video game companies up to $1 million for egregious failure to disclose. So it's really kind of a redundant law, at best it just sort of gets in the way and is unnecessary and distracts people, and at worst it's sort of a small step into regulating the video game industry. And this one, unlike previous steps, does appear to be constitutional, and so if it passes, I think it's somewhat problematic, because it's sort of we're on the slippery slope. We're taking a small step towards giving the government more power to regulate over content and sort of say what people can and can't see, which I don't think the government needs to have the power to do.
Peter, this is Adam. There have been some cases going back to the 1970s and 80s dealing with the constitutionality of government efforts, specifically state and local efforts, to co-opt a private ratings or labeling system and give it the force of law. And, of course, this came up in the context of the MPAA ratings after they started gaining more widespread use in the 60s and the 70s and 80s. Some state and local officials sought to impose restrictions on, say, outdoor cinemas or various other venues that showed certain movies and kids were in them, whatever else. And basically the courts have said again and again, this stuff is not constitutional, because it is a private, voluntary rating system that should not be given the force of law, because then essentially it is a de facto, or rather de jure, kind of situation where it becomes a government-based rating system. So there is some good law out there, and I think some of the scholars that have looked at this have been skeptical about even whether or not this would pass constitutional muster.
Peter, does the new law just provide for fines, or does it also have criminal penalties?
It's really actually very unclear. When I spoke to Upton's press secretary, he said that all he would really sort of explain about it is that it would give the FTC to the power to regulate it. Just all he told me was that our bill will simply underscore the FTC's role in a manner which will further deter the bad apples from trying to deceive the ESRB's system. So yes, it would give the FTC probably some ability to fine, but it does not create a new threshold of penalties. There's no specific architecture for, okay, if you do this, you'll get fined this amount. As Adam notes, we've seen this for a very long time, and really, I think sort of this, in some ways, the specifics of these bills don't really matter, because what they are is sort of an opportunity for politicians to take the stage and to sort of rail against a fairly unpopular industry, or at least an industry that's unpopular with voters. And they do this constantly sort of, you know, in the name of for the children, because the children, of course, can't vote. So it's, and they're really doing this for the parents who sort of feel confused and threatened by the video game industry. And then see, oh, well, we can get help from the politicians. We actually saw, there was something that came out today. Recently, a video game law that was written or co-written by sort of a notorious anti-video game activist Jack Thompson in Louisiana. That law was recently struck down in the courts. But the legislative sponsor of that law, Representative Burrell, wrote an op-ed in the Shreveport Times today, complaining about how the courts had struck the law down. And of course, what he says is, you know, I don't want to spend taxpayer money, but if I'm going to spend if I'm going to do it, it's going to be for the children. And you know, and uses phrases, you know, like mind-altering, harmful, ultra-violent video games. And tries to sort of convince people that that there's a lot of a large body of scientific research out there that suggests that video games cause increases in aggression. Even if that's true, I'm always skeptical of the increases in aggression line, because are we really going to regulate anything that increases aggression? I mean, I would imagine that wrestling and football and being on the debate team all increase someone's aggression. And yet we don't, you know, see calls to outlaw these for children. In fact, we love it when children play sports and are on the debate team. So I really think that most of this is just giving politicians an opportunity to showboat for parents, because the prime audience for video games, children, don't get to vote and don't have a say in this.
Peter, I understand. Go ahead, Jim.
Jim Harper here. I've been looking at the bill on Washington Watch, which we might turn to next. But one of the commenters mentions that this kind of thing was instituted with comics, printed comics, under the comics by the Comics Code Authority in the past. Have you looked at any of the historical precedents in terms of regulating or de facto censoring comic books to the video game area?
I'm aware of the Comics Code that was in place, but I don't know much about the legislative history there. But I do know that it was put up in response to a lot of the horror comics, and that for a long time, Marvel and DC, the big comics publishers, would not publish comics at all without the Comics Code stamp on it, and that now they do, so that it has become less of an issue, at least in recent years.
Adam, let me ask you a question. A few times you've made the argument that these kinds of private certification regulatory boards are a good thing because they forestall regulation. If this legislation passes, will that undermine that argument and be an example of how these private organizations can actually be an opening wedge for government regulation?
No, I don't think so. I think realistically, first of all, the industry is going to fight this tooth and nail. There's no way they're going to let this thing go through. I mean, I can't imagine it passing constitutional muster, but you never know. The reality is, though, is that these industries know that a lot of parents, a lot of people in the public value the information that go along with these private rating systems. Just this week, there was a new report issued by the ESRB. These are the folks that rate video games, and they've been for the last 7 or 8 years now polling parents about parental awareness and use of the private ESRB rating systems. Again, there's like 7 ratings, and then there's like 40 content descriptors in the ESRB rating system. It's a great system. The current numbers are just staggering in terms of how many parents are aware of it or use it. 85% of parents are using ESRB ratings when they make their decisions, and almost 90% are at least aware of the ratings. I mean, that's really impressive. Wow. Because that's parents are being empowered and given the information to make decisions. Yeah. About content on their own.
Well, that's actually a point I make in my article is that, you know, these systems are working extremely well. However, I'm a little uncertain about the industry response to this. When I contacted the ESRB about the about Upton's law, I could not get them to go on the record as saying that they were opposed to it. And in fact, all their statements to me, they started in saying things to the effect of, "We look forward to we enjoy working with Congress on this. The one I've got here says we share the congressman's interest in maintaining the integrity of the ESRB ratings and appreciate his longstanding focus on providing effective tools so parents can decide content, blah, blah, blah." And so, I mean, I would imagine that you're right, Adam, that they probably don't want this to be passed, but I've not seen any willingness to go on the record as being explicitly opposed or to fight it in any way. And my guess, you know, just totally, sort of an assumption here, but my guess is that they're a little bit afraid that if they fight things like this that don't actually ban any content, if they try to, you know, make an issue of it, that they're just going to sort of bring attention to themselves. And so it seems to me like they're playing a little bit of a different strategy on this than they have on some of the laws that have actually tried to ban content, which they have opposed.
Peter, besides bills, I understand we also have new songs against video game violence.
Well, not new, but I mean, this issue, it has been around for a long time. I mean, it first made waves in, I believe it was 93, when Joe Lieberman was on the floor of Congress and decried Mortal Kombat, which was sort of the very first violent video game, and a great game.
I know it made me a mass murderer.
Great movie, yeah, too.
Not so sure about that. But you know, so it's been around for a long time. And like a few years ago, there was a lawyer in Miami who was arguing something against Grand Theft Auto series, which one of the games in the series included a line, "Let's kill all the Haitians," and so he was representing a group of Haitians that were not pleased with this, and he, you know, sort of furthered his argument to include a lot of the violent, you know, video games will make you kill people, video games will, you know, destroy your children, and et cetera, et cetera. And he came up with a pretty amusing, if somewhat sad and pathetic song about his feelings, and I think you've got that.
Yeah, let's take a listen.
"Violent video game. I became so outraged that I thought, you know, the manufacturers, they need to be singing a different tune that's more in harmony with the people of our community. So I came up with this little song, and maybe this will sink in if the lawsuit doesn't."
Take it away.
"Who's walking down the streets of Vice City, shooting at everybody he sees? Who's looking out to slaughter his neighbor? The kids who are watching Vice City, they're taught that it's so much fun to kill with a knife or gun. They're taught that it's so much fun to take a life with a knife or with a gun. Who's walking down the streets of Vice City, shooting at everybody he sees? The kids of today are taught to kill and to kill anyone wherever they please."
I like it. I'm buying that CD, baby. That is great stuff.
Top 40 material all the way.
Catchy jingle, man.
But I think it's, you know, as long as we, you know, sort of we've got people, you know, we're listening to people like that sort of accuse video games of causing violence. You know, yes, there are a few studies that suggest that it increases aggression levels. As I've said, that's a really sort of weak thing to accuse video games of. It doesn't mean much to increase aggression levels. And if you look at the juvenile violence statistics since 1993, when more violent video games became more popular, juvenile violence has actually gone down pretty significantly in the past 15 years or so. So there's really no indication that these things actually cause trends in violence or cause anyone who wasn't predisposed to violence to be violent.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter. Well, next up, we're going to talk to Jim Harper, who's gotten in trouble with the law lately. So, Jim, what happened to you?
Well, I fought the law, and the law hasn't won yet. as a lot of people know, in my spare time, I operate a site called WashingtonWatch.com, where I apply cost and savings numbers that are expressed in terms of individuals and families to pending legislation. Well, I recently added wiki capability to it, so anybody, particularly people with expertise, can add information about bills to the relevant pages. And in doing some promotion on that, I put a thing out on PR Newswire comparing it to Thomas and the legislative system run by the Library of Congress, saying that it's a little easier to use and more accessible to the public than the Thomas system. Well, that got played out a few different places, showed up online, and came to the attention of the Library of Congress itself. And I got a lawyer letter of sorts from their, I think it's Director of Communications, saying that I shouldn't and maybe can't use Thomas or Library of Congress in promotional materials. This is not a trademark issue, though it seems a lot like it. This is under Library of Congress regulations. And I've read the regulations, and it says what it says, but I find it hard to believe that the Library of Congress, which itself is supposed to be a source of information and discussion and everything else, is actually trying to prevent discussion when it's part of the discussion. So the story went out on Ars Technica and then was picked up on Slashdot, and I've been very interested and pleased by the discussion there, not only of this issue, but also just the fact that people are talking about the site and thinking about access to government information, particularly access to information about the costs and the occasional savings of legislation pending in Congress. So I'm holding my breath that I don't actually get dinged by the federal government because they've got about $2.5 trillion a year that they could spend on lawyers. Hopefully they won't spend all of it on that, but it's been an interesting episode and helpful in the sense that it's gotten me some good PR, but it's concerning that the first thing that happens when I start to get some traction is that the government comes and says, hey, don't talk bad about us.
Jim, what exactly does the regulation say? I'm curious. How could it be worded to say that no one in the world can use the words Thomas or Library of Congress?
Well, it's unfortunately rather vaguely worded, and I think the intent of the regulation is to prevent the Library of Congress and its staff from using the Library of Congress's name in promotional materials. So it's intended to prevent the Library of Congress itself from applying the name to a promotional material saying, allowing someone to say this product is endorsed by the Library of Congress or this this play is a favorite of people at the Library of Congress. But they've taken it further and are trying to read it so that it means that a person promoting a product or service can't say anything about the Library of Congress or make comparative claims about the Library of Congress. So it analogizes to trademark law, but it's the allegation they're making is much, much broader than trademark, and that's that you can't even make comparative claims. I don't think there's any implication in the release that I put out that Thomas is in favor of WashingtonWatch.com, and certainly they're not now. But I should emphasize that Thomas is a great system, and it's a very useful system to people who are in the know. That's a valuable system, and translating the information that's there into more publicly accessible material is very helpful, I think. And so I don't really want to have a big, huge row with Thomas, and certainly not with their lawyers.
I don't know. I think maybe you want to take this head on and put out promotional materials that say, Library of Congress does not approve of WashingtonWatch.com.
Well, who knows if they would then hit me for using their name again in promotional material.
I think this is a theme you see coming up over and over again. I mean, we talked about it last week, about the idea that that if you want to bring publicity to someone, the best way to do it is to get in some sort of conflict with them and generate a lot of press. And so last week it was the AACS with Digg, and this week it's the Library of Congress with Washington Watch. And if someone is saying something about you that you don't like, the best thing to do is probably to ignore them, or at least to put out a press release of your own rather than some sort of legal thread.
I certainly was of two minds when this came to me, because one, I was worried. I don't want legal troubles. But two, I was like, oh, this is a gift, because this is a classic lawyer letter, and it's the big kahuna trying to tell the small upstart competitor, and I don't really view myself as much of a competitor, but in a sense I am, small upstart competitor, that you have to go away and using law rather than competition to try to keep a foothold. I'll run into this again in the future, I'm certain, as Washington Watch continues to gain traction and make inroads into the secrecy or the obscurity of what Congress does. I expect it'll all be in bigger fights than this in the future, and I intend to win.
Well, I just hope you have an LLC there to protect you, Jim.
I am working within the corporate form.
All right.
Yeah, Harper, I just want to let you know that I'm going to be filing comments on behalf of the Library of Congress, because I just find your work dreadfully boring and insane. So.
All right.
Anything to shut you up.
Easier to access, but boring. No, I think it's a pretty classic example of a government entity that has become so entrenched that it, you know, feels threatened by any sort of private competitor. And you know, we see this all the time, but this is a great example of the government, you know, of a public entity it's trying to protect its turf from private competition, and they don't know what to do with it, so they try to fend it off with legal threats.
I don't know. I mean, I think we're sort of assuming a lot of motivation on their part. We really don't know, though, I do have to say. Maybe this is something they do as a matter of course. You know, every day this guy gets a Google search email to him of every time Library of Congress was used in some PR release, and he sends out, as a matter of course, these cease and desist letters, just because that's what the regulation tells him to do, which, who knows, that might be more pernicious than
mindless bureaucracy rather than actively pernicious bureaucracy. take your pick.
I'd say that at a minimum they're overreading their authority.
Absolutely.
In this area and obviously cheating in the direction of favoring the Thomas and their own bureaucracy over a competitor, if you will.
So Harper, if they want to go to WashingtonWatch.com, it's WashingtonWatch.com or org?
It's www.washingtonwatch.com, and frankly, the attention that it's gotten has driven the commenting through the roof, and there are people not only on the homepage, you'll see the most popular bills, but across the spectrum of legislation, people are putting up information about the bills that are there, so I think a lot of folks inside the Beltway, though they're not editing the wiki quite yet, some are, but though they're not doing that en masse, they're starting to post information, so there's really, I'm starting to make headway into pulling information out of the corners where it resides here in the Beltway and get it, making it available to people. So that's exciting. Good things are happening there.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jim, and good luck with that. Finally, we're going to talk about Rupert Murdoch's surprise bid for ownership of the Wall Street Journal. Adam, you're a fan of British tabloids. Are we going to see...
just the page two girls.
Yeah.
Man, that's it.
Well, that's my question. Are we going to see Britney's latest antics in the front pages of the Wall Street Journal soon?
God, I hope so. Don't
Great.
You?
Are we going to have
those
woodcuts, page two girls and woodcuts?
First of all, I think it's too early to know if this is actually going to happen. But, you know, there are obviously concerns by a lot of people out there about Rupert Murdoch bringing his brand of journalism to the Wall Street Journal. I find that hard to believe because I think he'd want to buy the Journal, and he's putting a premium on his bid for them precisely because they provide a very unique type of dedicated long-form journalism about financial and business industry matters that really no one else in America can touch. And it is one of the great newspapers, not only in America, but in the world, precisely for that reason. If he was to go in to make it look a lot more like the New York Post, which he owns, what's the purpose of that? What's the value in that when there already is a New York Post or a USA Today or a lot of other, you know, magazines or newspapers that have Britney Spears on A1? So, you know, it remains to be seen. Now, the question is, are there any regulatory hang-ups here? From a technical, you know, regulatory point of view, no, because the Wall Street Journal is a national paper. It really seeks a national audience, not a local audience. Even though it's produced in New York City, or technically out of New Jersey, the parent company is, the reality is that doesn't mean anything for cross-ownership regulations because it's not being delivered just to New York City or the state of New York or the state of New Jersey. So that largely means that most of the traditional regulatory things that would kick in do not kick in here. That doesn't mean, however, that there won't be some people either at the FCC or in Congress who won't use this as an opportunity to maybe take another shot at trying to regulate industry and newspapers or broadcasting in some way, you know, because that's just they're opportunists about this and they always do that kind of thing.
One of the interesting things I thought about this was that the usual line you hear from the critics of these kind of mergers, especially with Murdoch, is, you know, that the corporate media is going to take over and push their right-wing agenda on whatever, you know, property they're wanting to buy out. And it seems unlikely that they're going to make the Wall Street Journal editorial page any more right-wing. So,
yeah, that's a good point.
If they are going to oppose it, they're going to have to come up with some new rationale.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's a good point, Tim. And also, you know, a lot of people try to make this argument about Rupert Murdoch's politics, but sometimes it's not so clear to me. I don't know if you saw this week, but Murdoch had this big announcement about News Corp going green and having all this environmental mumbo-jumbo that he was in support of. Moreover, let's not forget it was his company that put out that global warming propaganda film, The Day After Tomorrow. I mean, so what are we supposed to read from his decisions about media and entertainment? What I read out of it is the guy likes to make money. I mean, I don't read politics out of it. Sure, Fox News seems to be clearly a little bit right of center, but the reality is that I mean, this guy looks at this as a business opportunity, and I'd have a hard time believing that the journal's format or substance would change radically under his ownership. But maybe I'm wrong. It's certainly my favorite newspaper in the entire world. I hope it doesn't change much, and I doubt it would, but realistically, I don't even think this is going to happen because it sounds like there's a lot of detractors inside the Dow Jones Corporation and the family that owns the Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. I think there's a good chance the deal will probably be rejected.
Well, one thing that's happening that might provide some synergy for Rupert Murdoch in buying the Wall Street Journal is that Fox News Channel or his TV holdings, they're starting a competitor to CNBC, a Fox Financial Network. And it would make perfect sense to have the expertise and the infrastructure that comes along with the Wall Street Journal. So, I mean, I think that might be his main motivation for doing this.
I think that's a good point. I think clearly, obviously, that's something they want to do. I mean, they've been talking about that new financial channel for some time. That way they could more easily tap the Wall Street Journal's very talented reporters and editorial writers who have incredible expertise when it comes to business and market reporting. I can see there being synergies there. That doesn't mean that the deal is going to work out over time.
Peter, Fox already uses the Wall Street Journal's editorial staff. They've got a program that airs, I don't know, at 2 a.m. on Saturdays or something. I don't know why anyone who's, you know, any normal person would be watching it at that hour, but they do run that already. The most reasonable criticism, though, that I've heard of the possibility that Murdoch might buy this is not that he's going to drastically change the journal, but just that the journal will either soften or its coverage or refuse to cover some stories that might interest Murdoch, you know, where Murdoch has interest. But I still don't think that that's particularly likely to happen. And even if it is, what will happen is that the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all the other major papers that are competing with it will go in there and will cover Murdoch's interests even harder. And so it's not like there's going to be a lack of reporting on these things or these stories aren't going to come out. If other papers see that the journal is sort of slacking in this one area, they're totally going to take the opportunity to come in and do their own reporting and show up the journal and show the journal that it is, you know, and show the world that, you know, they see the journal's avoiding talking about Murdoch's doing whatever it is he's doing. And so I really don't see that this is going to be a problem at all. And, you know, the market for news will take care of itself somehow or another.
All right. So no page two girls on the Wall Street Journal, I was hoping.
Unlikely.
All right. Well, that's going to have to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this time. Thanks to Jim Harper, Tim Lee, Adam Thier, and Peter Suderman. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Jerry. Pleasure.
Thanks, Jerry.
To read more commentary from our panelists and the rest of the Technology Liberation Front gang, visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you have something to say about something we said, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Jerry Brito. See you next time.